I want to start by referring to voicing madness, and in rehearsing this performance, it's become clear that it helps if I make it clear at the start that if I try and voice madness, it's like trying to raise a question to which I have no answer. And if you're listening for an answer, you may not hear the question. When I first had the idea of trying to voice madness, I hadn't realized just how problematic it would be. So if you can allow me this problem that I think I'm trying to raise a question to which I don't have the answer. Now something about this voice work. I had a minor stroke 3.5 years ago, and the stroke affected my speech a bit, my face. And at the Radcliffe Infirmary in Oxford afterwards, when I was having some treatment and being given exercises for my tongue and moving my mouth and enunciating, and they were trying to find what sort of weakness I had, I found it necessary to say to the very good therapist I had there that I had a lifelong stammer, and that weaknesses or flaws in my speech that she might hear might not be caused by the stroke, but might be caused by the stammer. And I realized that this was the first time I talked about my stammer in a medical setting rather than in an analytic setting for, since my very early 20s when I was an undergraduate. And it started something for me, which I'm very grateful for the stroke for, because it got me addressing what has been a lifelong, or rather since the age of 5, problem with my speech in a new way, with medical people and then with my present therapist, who is Christian named Alexander, who you'll be hearing a lot of. Unfortunately, he was unable to be here. So under the encouragement of the therapist at the infirmary, she said, why don't you go up to the Warnford Hospital to the stammer unit there? They've got a very good reputation. So I thought I'd try that, and I went up to them, and she was very helpful. And in particular, she taught me what I'd been taught and told many times, but with a new authority, that one of the great things to watch if you have a stammer of the kind I have, is don't avoid the difficult words. If you feel a difficult word coming up, meet it head on, or is that the right phrase? Tongue on, and don't avoid it. And those of you who don't stammer or have not lived with stammers may not know how very, very clever we get at seeing the blocked words coming in advance and avoiding them if it's speech, though we can't avoid them if it's reading. And psychologically, this was a very significant lesson. It wasn't the first time I'd heard it, but it came over with a new authority that you must try and say the difficult word. I learned other things there, but that's the thing I want to emphasize. But then by chance, through the post, there came a circular about this man, Alexander Massey, who advertised himself as offering voice work under the heading Free Your Voice. So I rang him up and said, may I come? And I went to number 293 Cowley Road and met Alexander for the first time, a man in his middle to late 30s, who I've been seeing now on the whole weekly for about a year and three quarters. And he works with breathing, he works with singers, with public speakers, with children, with stammerers, in many contexts on voice. And he works with breathing, a lot of it is breathing exercises. And the breathing is very powerful. It links up into meditation and yoga practices, but it's also aimed at the techniques of speech, vocal production. But what I've learned with him, what I gradually learned, and what really has held me, is these three levels of speech, voice and breathing. And the discovery of this middle range of voice between speech and breathing. And when I go to him, we talk and we do exercises, and then I can start to shout and sing. And perhaps cry, I don't know what will come. I don't know what will come. It's this middle experience of voice as a resource, as a level of experience and expression between words, the kind of words one can get stuck on if one stammers, the words one needs to conceptualize and to create images. That between words and breathing, and the huge power and comfort of breathing, which is being an extraordinary reorientation for me. Through it and with it, I found myself revisiting many of the sites in my life and in a story which have been very important to me over 50 years now since I first went into analysis. But the access to them and the energy released and the fun and the danger and the excitement is very different. That it's not necessary to turn it into words, but the Alexander work does encourage me to try and relate sound to movement. And thinking about the whole profession of psychotherapy, sitting in a chair and talking, and on the whole talking out of the air on the top of your lungs, rather than the other air that I'm just about learning to use from down here, where sounds come out and you're not quite sure what you're going to say if you start speaking from down here. I don't want to overstate this, but it's making me wonder about the practice of just sitting in a chair and talking. Now I want to move on to the Hoey family. I promised myself I'm going to try and listen to my breathing, so but I must also give a responsible talk. Now, what about is the Holy Family, my Unitarian psychoanalytic introduction? I was brought up as a Unitarian, so I'm very happy to be here always. And I was brought up a lot on the Bible. My grandfather, my mother's father, was a Unitarian theologian, and we knew the Bible very well, but it was very firmly taught, and really was taught, that the Christian beliefs around the Holy Family were wrong, untrue, something we'd outgrown. One of my strongest memories of my father, who died over almost 40 years ago, was of him taking me out from school, my boarding school, and after the church service, which was a non-denominational school, but there had been references to Jesus Christ in the sermon, which had jarred with my father. And on the way out, him saying to me very strongly, "You are not to believe that. You are not to believe that. Jesus Christ was a great prophet man, but he was not whatever they were saying he was." And my father was not a man who expressed much, but that is one of my strongest memories of him. And when I went into analysis, which was Jungian, what happened was that my dreams began to be about the Holy Family, about the Christian Holy Family, about Mary and Joseph and Jesus and other members. I think many of these dreams were probably about my family of origin, about what I think of as the psychoanalytic family. But they were in terms of the biblical Holy Family. And I found myself reapproaching the Christian and biblical teaching about this. And over a period of about 10 years, I moved into being baptized and confirmed into the Anglican Church in order to get closer and into this mystery, where I felt there was a lot of power and stuff going on, which I had to get more involved with. And the way I remember it, and I think this is a fair recollection, is that the interest in the Holy Family, it was explicitly sexual in a way that still stays with me. And I hear things said in the church service which I doubt very much whether many of the others in the church are hearing, but it's there in the words if you prepared to allow it to be explicitly sexual. And it was around the virgin birth. And the writer and book, which was in those days what all Jungians read, was Esther Hardy, The Way of All Women, a book written, I think, about 1930. A wonderful book, but I imagine it reads very incorrect, perhaps, in feminist eyes today. But she, in her book Women's Mysteries, had a section on the virgin birth in which she was relating it to traditions in which the word virgin meant unmarried woman, and the idea that often in the Middle East, unmarried women would work as a prostitute in the temple, a courtyard, and until they had intercourse with a stranger, they weren't, as it were, ready to be married. And this idea caught me very much then, and it was one of the things that sort of drew me into the church. I felt this nonsense, which I'd been brought up to think of it as the virgin birth, which was a block, began to draw me into the church, but always in terms of explicitly being prepared to hear explicit sexuality in it. And though Esther Harding's formulations may not be accepted or agreeable anymore, the theme continues, and I have just been reading in preparation for this talk a book that's been on my shelves for 3 years, but I've not read it, which I also have with me, called The Illegitimacy of Jesus, which is a feminist theological, Roman Catholic feminist study of the infancy narratives in Luke and Matthew, in which she argues that an older tradition is being drawn on and can be seen there, referring to the illegitimacy of Christ, showing how the doctrine of the virgin birth gradually grew out of as a response to the problematic of that tradition. And the other area, which was about the Trinity, which for Unitarian is the ultimate nonsense. But as I've told elsewhere, the Jung Club recently, Irene de Castillejo, my first analyst, responded to one of the first things that happened in my therapy with her by lending me the newly translated typescript of Jung's lecture on the Trinity, which I always tell with a certain frisson, because I think for most analysts today that would be a scandalous interpretation to offer that as a comment to somebody, but it was a foundation experience for me in my analysis. And in that essay, of course, Jung draws on Egyptian, pre-Christian Egyptian theological similarities or parallels to the, and I see I dodged the word parallel there and said similarity in order to be able to come to parallel more relaxed, because I'd avoided it by going through similarity. What we do with Islam. And particularly the theme of masturbation, quite explicit and central in the Egyptian theology. And in my naive ex-public school boy, young man, middle-aged man, old man, explicitness, I've always thought father, son, and I still like to say Holy Ghost rather than Spirit. What is this third that the father and son have in common that has something to do with, well, at one end procreation and the other end something called possession? And I'm not interested in the Trinity except for the sexual overtones. I'm not trying to reduce it to sexuality, but I am insisting on hearing sexual resonances in what's being talked about there. So now let me give you this example of how it developed in relation to my work with Alexander last year in Lent. I was leading a Lent group in our parish, and it was the first time I've really tried to talk from my background as a Jungian analyst in our local church circles. What I said I was going to try and do was to talk about fear as a way into the Christian mysteries rather than love, because over the years in trying to match what goes on in my consulting room and in my private life and in my teaching, my writing, with what I share in church, it had come to me that this was a crucial problematic, as it were, that I mean, I have such doubts about love in the Christian tradition. I feel that that word is being made to carry so much that it breaks, as many Christian theologians will agree, that it breaks, what else is the crucifixion, but it breaks too much. And fear, the relationship between love and fear, that's what I was trying to talk about in my Lent group, and there was a good response. But then other things began to happen. The first was at the Stations of the Cross in our church, which my wife and I were at and are moving around. And the words we use in our church aren't old liturgical words. They are from a book called A Pilgrim's Way of the Cross, which was apparently written in 1970 by a man in America. But it was these words at the fourth station where Jesus meets his mother. And these are the words put into the voice of Christ. My mother sees me whipped. She sees me kicked and driven like a beast. She counts my every wound. But though her soul cries out in agony, no protest or complaint escapes her lips or even enters her thoughts. She shares my martyrdom and I share hers. We hide no pain, no sorrow from each other's eyes. This is my father's will. Now, I was just stopped by those words, and I felt that they belonged with the theme I was trying to talk about in the Lent group, and I must in some way take these words into the Lent group as problematic. And was helped in introducing some of my feeling into the Lent group. I was helped by the contrast of that presentation of the mother of Christ with the version given in a much older poem or song, which some of you may know and some of you may have sung, certainly heard it sung, Henry Purcell's Tell Me Some Pitying Angel, usually referred to as the Blessed Virgin's Expostulation. And the words were by Nahum Tate, I think, about the beginning of the 17th century. But I want to read it because it's a different version of how the mother of Jesus might react to a sense of how things were going. It's, as it were, set when he's age 12 and they go up to Jerusalem and he leaves her in the temple and is, as it were, lost. And she sings, tell me, some pitying angel, quickly say, where does my soul's sweet darling stay? In tigers or more cruel Herod's way? Oh, rather let his tender footsteps press unregarded through the wilderness where milder savages resort, the deserts safer than a tyrant's court. Why, fairest object of my love, why dost thou from my longing eyes remove? And now the questioning. Was it a waking dream that did foretell thy wondrous birth, no vision from above? Where's Gabriel now that visited my cell? I call. He comes not. Flattering hopes, farewell. Me, Judah's daughters once caressed, called me of mothers the most blessed. Now, fatal change of mothers most distressed. How shall my soul its motions guide? How shall I stem the various tide, whilst faith and doubt my labouring thoughts divide? For whilst of thy dear sight I am beguiled, I trust the God, but oh, I fear the child. Now, that seemed to me and to us as a group a very different presentation of the relationship between Mary and the fate and destiny of her son. And it certainly helped in our Lent group for a lot of sharing. I remember a woman sitting on my right, her comment on the Stations of the Cross I've read out were, only a man could write that, which is quite possibly true. But then also, in the same week or fortnight, at the Oxford Psychotherapy Society, we had an absolute down the centre of the road, fine, very good presentation of psychoanalytic work, research work on the role of the father in families under infant observation studies. And it was a very good presentation, and probably half or more of the audience were psychoanalytically trained. And it really got us into the whole sort of present-day, contemporary, on the whole psychoanalytic, but also wider than that, understanding, interest in the role of the father, how sometimes he's central, sometimes he's absent, how his role is understood. And the conjunction of that and the Lent group really sort of filled me with a sense of a very powerful problem and issue, something that I wanted to address in So I took it into my work with Alexander, whose name incidentally has nothing to do with the Alexander technique. When I speak of Alexander Massey, it's often thought gradually that this is some sort of Alexander work, but it's not, it's Alexander work, it's different. But, and he suggested that I use his room, where I do enjoy myself and I make some wonderful sounds. So he said, you take the three roles and voice them. I said, the four. And he just thought of Joseph, Mary, and Jesus. And I said, no, there's the Holy Ghost. So I did. And what happened was I moved and stood with my back to the door as Joseph. And there was no sense of being the cuckold or the immense power. My wife is pregnant, protection. Terrific sense of power, of containment, of recognition, of welcome, of that. Terrific sounds came from him. And then I went into over somewhere else and was Mary, and responded to my husband. So halfway through, stopping and remembering something else. And I know my voice changed and the sounds became very different indeed. And then I moved into the position of the child, which was about to be born. It was still in the womb. And as I remember it, there was there was a lot of puzzlement about, and so what's going on, but that's all sound. And then I moved into the position of the Holy Ghost, and it's true, it's not put on. I've forgotten entirely what I did as the Holy Ghost. But in the weeks and months afterwards, it left me with this, what did I do? What left with this problem of understanding the third person of the Trinity. And as I phrased it there, after quite a lot of rehearsal and sharing with others, those two questions, what happens to the Holy Ghost between begetting and procession? Remember, this is what the Eastern and Western churches split on about 1,000 years ago, the doctrine of the procession of the Holy Ghost. Is it from Father and Son, as the Catholic West chose, or is it from Father alone, as the East? It was, whatever that means, it means enough for two churches to anathematize each other. What are we talking about in this? This is the Holy Ghost that begot the Son, and it's also the Holy Ghost that won't come until I, the Son, this is the son speaking, has gone to the father. What's happening there? I mean, the wonderful, very powerful, terrifically powerful worlds of theology have been built on this, the margins of which I've read and been fascinated by. But when I consult my reading, they don't seem to address the sexual. And I know theologians say they do, but begotten, not made. We say this in the Creed, begotten, not made. What is, there's something being said here about the mystery. And it's here that I feel I'm raising a question. And I don't know the answer, but I want to try and sort of end back in some of the exercises with Alexander to show how I'm living, how I'm exploring it now. But I think it's quite wise to have a moment of pause between myself and the audience here to own the fact that I'm trying to raise a question to which I haven't got an answer. And what kind of hearing does one expect then? Because people are listening for the answer. And how does one hear a question? When I do my stammer stuff with Alexander, he often says, I think, rather naive things. And I say to him, I think that's, as a very experienced analyst, I'm rather naive. But he says, what are you afraid of saying? Now, when you stand, what are you afraid of saying? And the thought came to me a few weeks ago, perhaps it's not that I'm afraid of saying, but that I'm afraid the listening isn't there. So I can't, how does one speak when there's no listening? What one has to say, there's a relationship between mouth and ear. If the ear's not there, how can I say it? And he accepts that. And so we go back into breathing exercise. We drop below language and voice and breathing. So I want to end by just demonstrating two of the exercises I do. Exercises which are exploring this theme of exhalation and inhalation, which comes first. If you're told to take a deep breath, which do you do first? Do you breathe in or do you breathe out? But when he first asked me that, I said, of course one breathes in. But he says, and he told me yesterday that this work comes from somebody in Germany. It's not from this man's school. That it's argued that we are all either natural exhalers or inhalers. That either it's natural to exhale first in order that the lungs can fill, or it's to inhale in order that it can breathe out. And certainly this has reminded me a lot of some of my work with Jung's concepts of extroversion, introversion. But this exercise is to somehow do this exhaling and inhaling, inhaling and exhaling, and trying to relate it to where the breath comes in the body, whether it's from up here or down here. On the whole, three levels of the body he encourages me to explore: up here, and sort of the back there here. And the two exercises I want to show, which have somehow been so powerful to me over the last few weeks, and I know they've been influenced by thinking about preparing this talk, are these. So I think I shall now have to move out from this, but I won't be talking, so it doesn't matter.
The speaker then demonstrated two exercises, which he does, one with the arms folded across the chest to his shoulders, and the other with with his arms held behind his back. During these exercises, he did some deep breathing and also made voice noises.
That exercise, I found myself thinking of the figure on the cross. And this contrast between that with the sort of protected chest and this figure there was a... I'm not sure if it's correct, but I have been told that if one's crucified, the first thing that goes is one's lungs, and that's what kills one. Lungs burst. So you see, the question I'm asking myself is about the breath. Oh, the breath. The breath. What does that central image of our faith and culture and history, what does it do to the breath? How does it compare with all those Eastern traditions which center on breathing? And if one has been working for a long time sort of psychoanalytically and was aware of connections between breath and sexuality, and some of these Eastern exercises of trying to breathe, the sort of things we do in the Tai Chi also, breathing through all the parts of the body and allowing the thought of breath circulating in all the lower parts of your body and fingers and toes and everywhere. It does very easily link breathing with sexuality. What is happening? And I have on my notes two sort of rather sobering readings to try and close on. What I'm trying to address is what I call the reversal of direction in one's breathing. What I find so powerful in these breathing exercises is this very simple, very obvious fact that we have to breathe in and out, and that involves a reversal of direction. And if one stammers, one's immensely aware of this as an issue. It's a sort of interruption of the in and out, and that's where the power of these meditative things is, in this extraordinarily simple, familiar, but indefinitely powerful thing, and it involves a reversal of direction. And there have been these two times, at least, that occurred to me in my life when this idea of reversal of direction has emerged with great power. And the first one I have here was when I was talking to the guild, again on the third person of the Trinity, though it was a very different approach to what I have now. And I was trying to approach it in terms of Jung's extroversion and introversion. And I spoke of how I had been meditating on this for many months in relation to a particular experience. And then I had been reading Gershom Scholem's book on Jewish mysticism, a subject about which I knew nothing, a big book. And I was reading it fast, allowing all the images to pour through me, these very poetic, highly mystical language about creation. And I came on this passage where he's talking about a figure called Isaac Luria in the 16th century in Spain. And I said I better quote Scholem directly, so I'll read out the Scholem quote again. By putting a question which gives the appearance of being naturalistic, and if you like, somewhat crude, Luria asks, how can there be a world if God is everywhere? If God is all in all, how can there be things which are not God? How can God create the world out of nothing if there's no nothing? The solution became, in spite of the crude form which he gave it, of the highest importance in the history of later Kabbalistic thought. According to Luria, God was compelled to make room for the world by, as it were, abandoning a region within himself, a kind of mystical primordial space from which he withdrew in order to return to it in the act of creation and revelation. So the first act of all is not an act of revelation, but one of limitation. More than that, every new act of emanation and manifestation is preceded by one of concentration and retraction. Every stage in the cosmic process involves a double strain, the light which streams back into God and that which flows out from him. And but for this perpetual tension, this ever-repeated effort with which God holds himself back, nothing in the world would exist. And when, but the point of I was trying to make then was the shock of that image of fundamental and widely felt to be heretical vision that, as I understand, Scholem to be saying, split the mystical world of the Jewish tradition into two camps. And it had to do with the same sort of thing as Jung was speaking of, extroversion and introversion, but I'm now speaking of in terms of breathing and this holding of the back, that the power of this breathing in and out, it has this power over one, and the kind of power that the meditation traditions and techniques draw on, because it is perhaps related to creation, to the fact that there has to be some sort of reversal of direction. And then to answer your question about the dream, this was a much earlier one. This was a dream I had in 54 at the time when I was sort of moving into, beginning to think I might be moving towards the church. And it was certainly the dream from which I date my interest in what I have called in my teaching and writing over years, ontology, the problem of the logos of being. And within the dream, a dream within the dream. This inner dream is a long murder story whose function is to persuade the dreamer he's a murderer in imminent risk of discovery. I've had the dream untold times before. It is indeed at the root of my worry and fear of life. But this time, I alter it to show that its grip on me is gone. It is as if at the crucial moment, which contains the whole point of the story, my mind turns and says, no, this is not real for me, and a clenched hand is unclenched. And as a result of this unclenching, I see a great design, a world picture. It is made up of an intricate arrangement of an endlessly repeated theme. The theme is of a tree growing in a formal courtyard at the top of a flight of steps. These steps lead down to a square pool of water. And although the water is still, there is immense energy generated in that pool. And between the tree and the pool, there flows a narrow red stream, though it is not clear in which direction. And this stream is the life of man. This theme of the tree and the pool is repeated an infinite number of times. It is as if everyone who'd ever lived spent his life painting one such tree pool picture. All the separate pictures are arranged together to form part of a great tree. But I see that in one of them, the direction is reversed. This means that in one of them, the direction of flow of this red stream between the tree and pool is reversed. And this reversal of direction spoils the whole picture. And seeing it, I feel an indescribable horror. It has something to do with a reversal of direction in masturbation, which is connected with the locking of my stutter. And it was that dream I'd spoken of umpteen times in analysis, but I first read it out in public at this Jung talk when I was trying to speak about projection. And my first attempt to try and talk about what I subsequently called ontology. But that reversal of direction, again, it seemed to me that this it's explicitly there about my stammer. When James Hillman published it, it was Patricia Berry, asked me to try and say more about the reference to masturbation there. And in the printed paper, there is an extra bit of the end in which I try and relate that to what Hillman, in one of his papers, has called an interior theological dispute. But it's somehow the power, the simple power of these breathing exercises. Again and again, they seem to access quite so naturally and easily. These exercises one can do in the home, in one's study or bathroom, Alexander. Yeah. And it's so easy and so normal and so obvious, but it's also so extraordinary. And for stammerers, you know very well that it is possible in ways, I believe, if you train yourself to speak on the in-breath. But speech on the whole is carried on the out-breath. It all depends on the in-breath. And I think that hearing has a lot to do with the in-breath. I think what one's somehow relying upon out there, the audience hearing, is the in-breath, allow the words to be spoken.
A huge trepidation, just to say that it is a wonderful moment for me to hear you talking about this reversal of direction. Because just 2 evenings ago, there's nothing I can say about it except to say that I needed to reverse direction in some way. And it was the first time I had actually encountered the fear that I experienced in trying to reverse direction in some part of me. And I used that phrase that you used, reverse direction. And that's all I can say about it. Except that in doing so, it seemed as I dropped into a hole, a vacancy, an absence, and lost the identity that I thought I had, and it had to go somewhere else, somewhere behind me, to hold me into the two separate parts. And move into another direction, which felt like not me, but it must have been me. But all I'm saying really is that it seems to me that what you're saying about in-breath and out-breath, reversing direction, is something very profound to me at the moment. Thank you very much.
I was very struck when you were using words. It's what we do when we're very small children, so that the voice carries our body and our feelings. When we're not using it in speech, it carries so much.
There is certainly something of that freedom of life. My youngest granddaughter is just about learning words now, but that thing between 6 months and 15 months, you know, all that sort of gabble, with motto words and some words, and they know perfectly well what they're saying, in a way one knows too, but, and in the very interesting chapters in Paul Neilan's book, he very much tries to relate his work to that, and there's a wonderful video about an order through his organization of him working. And perhaps that gives me my opportunity to refer to one of, I think, the most moving experiences he has there. And he speaks of work he did in some unit where the people had been born with brain damage and they weren't able to speak. And an awful one. And these sort of noises, and he said, "Now listen to what they're saying." And he began to be able to respond, and he was able to restructure the whole unit in which they were being cared to, in some way, vocalize with them. And the crucial, he describes it as almost the crucial moment in his own development as a voice worker. He was on holiday. He'd heard these sounds a lot in the unit. And he was on holiday in, I think it was Turkey. I said, "I think it was Turkey." I knew it was Turkey, but I was sticking on Turkey. So I said, "I think it was Turkey." Turkey. No problem. And he was walking down the village street and he passed a house and he heard coming from inside that house noises, sounds. And they reminded him of this sound, and he said to himself, "Now, I don't know whether that is somebody praying or grieving or having a row or what, but it's like that sound." And when he went back into the unit, he took with him that sense of, "I don't know whether it's grief, somebody howling or praying or arguing or having a row with somebody." And it was somehow from that conjunction of experiences that he began to be really convinced that he had a ability and calling to start a whole movement of voice work.
An awful lot since we've been talking, and it reminds me that also when I do Tai Chi, I yawn a great deal, so that it's always noticed. And when I do my Pilates, which is all to do with breath exercises, breath and stretching and relaxing, I also yawn all the time, so that I'm told to yawn more quietly. Because there is a sort of, and I've been yawning all the time here, and I'm not particularly tired, and I've certainly been riveted by it.
I saw you yawning, and it made me realize that I hadn't demonstrated that when I reached it, which I certainly meant to, because it's one of Alexander's, I find, most useful exercises. Try and make yourself yawn 10 times. You know, I've not been able to get more than about 6. But it's a wonderful exercise, because you can do one or two. You have to, and it breaks down barriers of what's respectable and what's not, but it also gets all kinds of connections between your face and your tightness and your arms and your lungs. Trying to get up those yawns a third or fourth time, it's there's some quite embarrassing analogies with it. It's a very good exercise if you want to break through sort of surface persona stuff about voice and also the control of your face.
Can I just say that I enjoyed your talk very much indeed? I don't think I could articulate why. But no doubt my wife and I will discuss it afterwards and we get maybe an answer. But I think that in raising the point, what kind of a hearing can I expect if I try to raise a question to which I have no answer? For me, it doesn't really matter if you don't even raise a question, certainly if you don't even attempt to answer the question you have raised, provided we go away and maybe ask a question and eventually come to some sort of answer, that's really all that matters, isn't it?
I'm very glad to hear that. I was very encouraged at a meeting of the Oxford Psychotherapy Society this year when we had a presentation about psychoanalysis with psychotic patients, I think. And the man presenting was working in an institutional setting and he described work with two patients. And it was a very psychoanalytic presentation. I was interested, but I felt as it went on, I won't be able to speak into this. I could feel all the psychoanalysts around me sort of buzzing with I'm learning the whole time, but I can't speak into it. But then one woman behind me asked him about one of the dreams a patient presented, which had been about bellows. And as she asked the question, I thought, now I've got to speak, because of course this is about breathing. And he was very good in the discussion. He really related to the questions. And so I said my thing about this voice work and breathing, and he came back with a very strong yes and referred to a time in his training as a clinical psychologist where the professor had said to the class, all point to where you think the self resides. And he said, a few nutters would point to there. But most people, they pointed to there. That's the top breath. Why do you say breath there? So I came back and said, but how about there and here? If they point there, do you think that? I know afterwards, I find myself wondering, is the whole psychoanalytic enterprise, in fact, here? And what happens when you go down there? It was well prior to my work with Alexander. I had one off session with a woman called Patsy Rodenberg, who teaches the actors of the National Theatre voice. And I had a one off session with her in a kind of big soundproof squash pot of a place. And she was very concerned to establish breath from here. And she had some sort of thing where she had me on the floor with my legs over me and breathing. If I started to speak from there, and she says that's what they aim to get all actors and actresses speaking from down there, I just don't know what I'd say. You know, all my conscious control of my speech is up here. And there's another place where language could come from there. I don't want to speak from there. I don't know what to happen. But I would think very much that there is a huge opening for experiment and work there. And I think very likely that the kind of work being done in what they call cognitive analytic therapy in the National Health, limiting it to 12 sessions, if they align that to voice work too, you can really get a sort of confidence that there's something there that you needn't be able to put into words, but you can still access it.
By way of a thank you, I'm going to tell a small anecdote. I don't know if you remember this, David, but we met outside the post office in Wolvercote about 2 years ago. And, you know, we exchanged pleasantries and I said to David, how are you? And he said, well, I've just been asked to do this group, this Lent group by the parish. And I don't know what to do. And I said to you, I said, well, David, one thing, you'll certainly stir them up. And then I think we talked a little bit more and you said to me, you've answered my question. And I never knew what the question was, and I certainly didn't know what the answer was. Thank you very much, David.